And the first case on that docket is the Douglas case. And are the parties ready to proceed in reference to that case? I do have correspondence from counsel in reference to, I guess it's dated February the 21st, regarding you're alleging that it's somewhat moot, but that you want to proceed. Is that correct, sir?
I do want to proceed, yes.
Okay, very well. Counsel understands you have 15 minutes, and do you desire to reserve any time for rebuttal, sir?
I would like to reserve 5.
Okay, very well. Thank you. You may proceed when you're ready.
And let me suggest you start off by addressing the mootness issue, so because obviously
sure.
we don't do advisory opinions. So tell us why it's not moot.
Well, there are the reasons I set forth in my letter. There is still a fine that he has to pay prospectively. The fact of the revocation can be scored prospectively if he's ever charged with a felony in the future, either in state or federal court. Those are the consequences that immediately jump to mind at the very beginning. The second thing, after I wrote that letter, I anticipated that I might be asked something about it today. When it comes to First Amendment claims, the issue of it's more grounded in terms of standing. But even though you may not have a particular injury, articulable injury as the plaintiff in asserting the First Amendment claim, if you are a part of a sufficiently large class where
suggesting it's a chilling effect.
Exactly. It's a chilling effect.
On a probationer's right to view pornography.
Well, I can address that, the whole thing about the pornography, in a little bit more detail, but in the body, if you would like, I'd go straight there.
Well, let's back up and let's start from the beginning, or part
sure.
of the beginning as we know it, because I know that there was another case and it was, you know, it was bifurcated, so we didn't have some of the record and we had part of the record. But nevertheless, okay, so he's convicted of the indecent liberties on March the 14th of 2015, right?
In Roanoke City Circuit
okay,
Court.
Right, okay. So his first revocation, or his revocation right after that, he'd had a revocation before, but the revocation right after that was July the 23rd. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
That's in the Salem case.
Okay, and that would have been when the order went down, right?
That's correct.
Okay, very well. And in that order, the judge said that the probation officer would set the terms and conditions of probation, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So then, on July the 28th, he met with his probation officer. Probation officer testified that, at this later proceeding, testified that he explained everything to your client. And then, again, on August the 11th, the senior probation officer met with him and went over the same conditions with him. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Okay, good. We're in agreement about a few of those things. I know,
yes,
I know.
We are.
I know. We're going to fall off in a few minutes, so I'm sure of it.
I'm waiting. I knew it was coming.
Well, it's like that train, you know. It's coming. So when the violation report, the major violation report, was reported on September the 22nd of the same year, and then, of course, went to trial, these terms and conditions of probation had been in effect all that time, and the order that imposed those terms and conditions would have been dated back in, would that not have been the July 23rd, 2015?
That is correct.
Okay. Then how do you get to that when you've got this nice little thing called Rule 1-1 of the Supreme Court rules that says that, you know, after 21 days, can attack it. You're attempting to collaterally attack that order. So tell me how you can do that.
Well, Judge Humphreys at the petition stage asked me the exact same question.
Okay.
And I tried to do as good as I could at the time. I figured I might be asked again, so I'm going to try to do a little bit better.
Okay, thank you.
But you're much more thorough.
Thank
no offense,
you.
Judge.
She's a better cross-examiner than I am.
Oh, no.
The order is a generic order. It is my understanding that the 23rd Judicial Circuit does not have, has published or created anything known as the standard conditions of probation. Okay, it's just the judges say the standard conditions of probation, and the probation department has their form that they use as the standard conditions of probation. And then subsequently, you have the sex offender conditions of probation. The I think what underlies this is that first of all, in response to Judge Petty's comment, this is not just about pornography. The sex offender condition that is at issue here has two prongs. The first prong is the possession and owning of sexually explicit materials, which he's not accused of violating. He is accused of the second prong, which is the viewing prong, which viewing any visual images, any written materials that causes him to act in an abusive behavior or acts.
Let me interrupt you if I can. Are you familiar with our relatively recent case in Wilson versus Commonwealth, decided a couple of months ago, I think?
Not off the top of my head.
Came out of the 23rd Circuit. Apparently, they do things very strangely down in these probation violation cases. That was a case like this one where the court delegated to the probation officer the ability to set some terms and conditions of probation. In that case, it involved restitution. And we held, and this probably helps you, but we held in that case that the statute, which is 19.2-303, makes it clear that terms and conditions are set by the court, and they can't delegate that to anybody else, including a probation officer.
Thank you, Judge.
Having said that, we also said in that case that you, as Judge Chaffin just pointed out, Rule 1:1 applies, and because it doesn't impact on the subject matter jurisdiction of the court, if you've got a problem with what the court did, you've got to raise it either immediately or at least within 21 days of the entry of that order. You can't wait until you get violated and then say, oh, by the way, not only can you not violate me, you shouldn't have done this to me in the first place. And that would probably also apply to your due process argument as well. If there was a due process issue with what the probation officer was doing, it should have been raised, you know, at that point in time. So tell us why it's not basically barred as a collateral attack.
Well,
given our jurisprudence in Wilson.
First of all, my client did not have notice that when he went to meet with the probation officer that these special conditions were going to be imposed.
But he could have gone to court at that point and said, I don't like these terms and conditions that this probation officer, not only does he not have the authority to do it, but he's not giving me enough notice. I mean, because we're talking procedural due process here,
sure.
I assume, not substantive due process. So, I mean, I didn't get any. You need to raise all these things before the court and not wait until you get violated.
Well, he had five days from the time he got convicted when he met with the probation officer and he found out what those rules were and he didn't like them. Apparently, he didn't like them,
sure.
Or we wouldn't be here. But he didn't like them, but he didn't say anything. And then he goes on down and meets with the second probation officer, the senior, on August 11th. Still didn't say anything, and within that time, he certainly had the opportunity to go back and request from the very same court that convicted him a motion to reconsider. And you know, if he failed to do that, he could have always appealed it within that time frame, that 30-day time frame, because he knew those things at that time.
As I told Judge Humphreys back at the petition stage, that is absolutely correct. The only way he could have done this would have been to go back, you know, file a motion to reinstate, get back and forth in front of the court and say...
Right. Well, I realize that if everyone did exactly what they should do, all of us would be jobless. I understand that.
We wouldn't have a whole lot to do on our court.
Yeah. We appreciate it. It hasn't happened that way. And believe it or not, we all practice law, too, at some point in time. So we understand.
No, I think your point is well taken. The court should not have delegated what it did to the probation officer. That's the court's job. And I think we try to make that clear in Wilson. But we also made clear in Wilson, and we're of course bound by that precedent, that you need to raise it at a point in time before you can take it up for the first time on appeal. You need to raise it at the time. It's because it's one of those void versus voidable situations. It's not void because the court had subject matter jurisdiction, but it's voidable because the court acted outside its statutory authority, which means you got to void it or seek to void it at a time when the court still has jurisdiction to do so.
Your Honor, I agree. I'm not giving up, but I agree.
But I think you need to find a way around Wilson if you can.
Okay, well, where I was going with that is that he was violated on the second prong of the special condition, and, you know, which is, I think, is so incredibly broad and incredibly vague no one, the probation officer didn't know, and the defendant didn't know what conduct was prohibited by the viewing prong. It was any visual images, any written material that caused him to act in an abusive fashion. Well, does that include...
Is there any question that the material that he was alleged to have viewed meets the definition imposed by the probation officer?
Yes. There is a question because, well, first of all, the circuit court conflated the two prongs. You know, he never possessed a sexually explicit, I mean, he wasn't violated for possessing and owning. He was violated for viewing. And from the viewing point of view, does reading 50 Shades of Grey violate the second prong? Does reading a Fabio novel?
Reading 50 Shades of Grey, was it? I mean, I thought there was no question that these were pornographic websites.
I agree with you, but the second prong is written in such a way that there has to be something that he looks at or reads has to cause him to act in an abusive manner or accent his abusive cycle.
Counsel, didn't he, in fact, though, even if we set that aside, didn't he, in addition to some of the other things that he did, wasn't he less than truthful with his probation officer when this was discussed?
That's correct. He denied it initially.
Okay, so isn't at least I think it's a universal term of probation that you have to be honest with your probation officer. You have to be cooperative and honest with your probation officer. I mean, isn't that part of probation anywhere that I know of? It generally is. Wouldn't he have, any way you look at it, there are a number of ways he could have been violated and was violated.
Well, as far as answering your question, all of this assumes that this is about pornography. But, you know, and Judge Broadhurst specifically found that the defendant, the probation officer, knew exactly what they were talking about, and he knew exactly what they were talking about. But pornography is only the first prong, and that's not what he was violated under. Now, the question is that when he had that conversation and made that denial, okay, did he understand that he could look at certain things, and that was okay?
Well, you know, pornography is protected by the First Amendment.
Sure.
Obscenity is not. And I know we use the terms interchangeably, but they're not interchangeable.
I agree.
So, but you, of course, can, as part of the grace of getting probation, give up some of your rights. And here he signed the conditions of probation, which the probation officer set, which included these particular conditions, did he not?
That is correct.
He didn't object to them at the time.
That is correct.
And in fact, he didn't object to them until he got violated.
That is correct.
For it. So, you know, if we circle back, I guess, to the original question, when you agree to something, you don't attack it, you don't say it's too broad, it violates a right that I'm not waiving as part of this probation that I'm getting. You know, that you take it back to the judge and say, Judge, you know, we gotta talk about this, and let the judge then decide what to do. None of that happened here.
I agree. Just as to the second prong, neither the probation officer nor the defendant knew what they were agreeing to. Likewise, in the circuit court, no one in that room, when we did that hearing on November 11th, knew what was prohibited by the second prong. And I respectfully submit that none of us here today No.
Well, Justice Stewart didn't know obscenity, except he couldn't define it, but he knew it when he saw it. So.
But still, I mean, we're having this give and take about he agreed to something. You know, I mean, did he know what he was agreeing to?
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but as you can see, you're running on to your rebuttal time, and certainly you're welcome to do that. That's it.
I didn't notice. I'll sit down and yield the floor to Mr. Cassidy.
We'll give you a minute left of it, okay?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. If I may begin by addressing the mootness issue, I would assume without conceding that the matter is not moot. There is a constellation of jurisprudence, particularly Brumfield versus Commonwealth. That's an unpublished opinion of this court, 09 Virginia unpublished 1462083, a 2009 case. That's the extreme example where all of the time is served and there are no remaining issues, which is different than the matter before the court. At the opposite end of the spectrum, I would point the court to Cartwright versus Commonwealth Transportation Commissioner. It's a Supreme Court of Virginia case, 270 Virginia 58, a 2005 case, and it concerns the outstanding payment of costs arising out of the context of a FOIA dispute, writ of mandamus, where the material is provided, but there's still costs associated. In that circumstance, it was not moot. And Tazewell County School Board versus Brown, a 2004 case of the Supreme Court of Virginia, 267 Virginia 150, where a principal had been suspended but reinstated and his personal reputation was adversely affected. The court found there that the issue was not moot. There was still a remedy that the person could obtain. And so to the extent that this is analogous, the future probation violation, it would certainly be reasonable to conclude that it is not moot to reach the merits of the case. I would
appreciate that.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would begin by pointing out in the assignments of error in this case, there is not an assignment of error concerning uncertainty as to the conduct prohibited. There is an assignment of error related to the condition and whether it was reasonably related to the petty larceny offenses and the authority of the probation officer. But I would submit that there has been no assignment of error granted by this court concerning whether it was properly defined so as the petitioner or the defendant understood what was prohibited, and that's not an issue before the court today. With respect to the argument that it was not reasonably related, I would submit that the defendant errs by focusing solely on the nature of the petty larceny offense. And as the court is aware, in reviewing whether a condition is reasonable or unreasonable, we look at the surrounding circumstances, the nature of the offense, the defendant's background. And here, given the specific context of the later attempted indecent liberties and the actual event that necessitated the revocation, it's clearly appropriate. And it would require the probation officer to ignore a risk to the community to do nothing about it.
Mr. Katz, as to the issue raised by Judge Humphreys with the Wilson case, and Wilson involved the delegation of the amount of restitution involved with the probation officer. Does Wilson preclude, in this case, the probation officer imposing this rule of probation?
I would submit, consistent with the Supreme Court of Virginia's opinion in Reese versus Commonwealth, that notes that the direct supervision is more readily accomplished by a probation officer rather than the court, that the court sets a general expectation and leaves the direct supervision to the probation officer.
I think the question related to setting the terms of probation.
Well, and I think
not supervision.
I think here the court recognizes, and this is at 3 and 8 of the appendix, the actual orders of revocation, that it may be necessary for a heightened level of supervision, and the court leaves that to the probation officer to determine.
Well, normally the orders, at least the ones I was familiar with, one of the conditions of probation is to obey the reasonable rules and restrictions, regulations of the probation officer. Now, if the if that is included in the order and the probation officer says you have to report to me once a week, and he doesn't report once a week, can he be violated for that condition? Can the court delegate that kind of authority to the probation officer?
Well, and clearly, given the precedent of Wilson, I mean, it is obviously not the best practice to do it the way this court did it. But again,
19.2303 says that one option the court has is to place a defendant on probation under such conditions as the court shall determine. And then it goes on to give examples such as GPS monitoring or other similar device as a condition of suspended sentence, et cetera. And then and it talks about possibility of community service under terms and conditions which shall be entered in writing by the court. So, I mean, it doesn't mention probation. Now, I think Judge Petty's point is, at what point does the rubber meet the road? You know, obviously the probation officer has to have some discretion. For example, and apparently this isn't the case in the 23rd Circuit based on the representations made by your opponent, but in most jurisdictions I'm familiar with, there's a standard set of conditions that apply to every probationer, which includes things like notifying your probation officer about employment changes or address changes or, you know, things of that nature. And that those are ordered by the court, but that order gives the probation officer the latitude to give permission, for example, to go out of the state to attend a funeral or a wedding or whatever, that sort of thing. And I think that's what Judge Petty is referring to. Where does the, you know, where's the tension that, you know, at what point is it permissible for the court to hand off the details of the supervision to the probation officer?
And I think the record in this case indicates that the document that Your Honor is referring to, which sets forth conditions, were generated and derived by the probation officer in accordance with the order of the court that delegated that authority. And clearly, under Wilson, that's not permissible at this point. I think this court was guided by the jurisprudence in Miller and the jurisprudence in Miller that indicated the probation officer had the authority to decide what was permissible and what was impermissible. And clearly at this point, that's probably not viable. And
it makes a certain amount of logical sense, it seems to me, if you have been convicted of a crime involving molesting children, for example, that you, as a condition of probation, you not watch kiddie porn or look at kiddie porn. Now, how do you define kiddie porn? That may be something that's, you know, left to the discretion of the probation officer to determine what websites or magazines or whatever are appropriate or not. Yeah. But again, those parameters should be objected to at the time if you have a problem.
Well, I think it's inescapable that the issue is not preserved for appellate review. And whether today, after Wilson, would dictate a different outcome, I think is beyond what this court can review at this point.
Mr. Katz, can you speak to the issue that the court discussed with counsel previously as far as a bar based upon Rule 1-1 in reference to this? Obviously, the time frame is gone. What is your position in reference to that?
I would agree that the issue was not preserved. It was not timely raised at a time when the court could do something about it. And the trial court was deprived an opportunity to rule on that, and it would be inappropriate to review it at this time.
Well, the trial court didn't even know at the time what the reasonable rules to be imposed were. I mean, the trial court said follow the reasonable rules of the probation officer, but then that was the end of it as far as the court was concerned. Why can't the court do something about it when it comes back on a revocation and say, you know, you didn't have the authority to impose that rule, Mr. Probation Officer, so I'm not going to revoke the probation?
I suppose that would gut the 21-day rule under 1:1. If the order is entered and the individual is revoked at some later date, that's too late a time to contest the contents of the order. I would say that it's incumbent upon a defendant within 21 days of the offending order.
The trial court could clearly determine whether the rule was reasonable or not at a subsequent revocation hearing, couldn't it?
Well, I suppose if the question is a revocation under this viable, I mean, clearly that would be before the court at that time. But if we're challenging the contents of the order, I would submit that it's too late at that juncture. So if Your Honor is suggesting that perhaps a defense to a revocation is, well, this was unreasonable on its face, then I think I agree that would be a viable defense.
What was in the order that should have been appealed?
Well, and I don't want to make the defendant's argument for them, but I suppose it would be that special condition L as applied to the suspended sentence for the petty larceny.
Special condition L, you're talking about the order saying that he could be supervised as a sex offender?
Well, so In the attempted indecent liberties order that suspended the sentence conditioned on probation supervision was this requirement to avoid certain manners of pornography. And the order suspending the petty larceny time and putting him on supervised probation simply delegated to the probation officer, which the probation officer in their supervision applied that provision to these felony petty larceny convictions. So that would be the fact that that had been done, I suppose, would be the challenge.
That's my point. There was nothing in the petty larceny revocation order that could be appealed.
Well, clearly, by the time the defendant met with the probation officer, it was evident that he would be held to that standard as it related to the felony petty larceny convictions. And so what would be appealed at that point, if that were problematic for the defendant, would be the language saying, well, you've made this supervision in the felony petty larceny.
What if the probation officer doesn't have time to meet with the defendant until the 21-day period has expired? Your argument would seem to suggest that he's just out of luck.
Well, it was clearly the degree to which the supervision had been delegated was evident on the face of the order. And so to the extent that that posed a problem for the defendant, it would have been apparent at the time the order was entered, whether one met with the probation officer within 21 days or outside of 21 days. If the fact of the meeting with the probation officer and the delegation of his discretion entirely is the problem, then that is apparent on the face of the order, patent from the order. But again, it was not presented to the trial court at the time. And I would submit a defense to the revocation does not cure that problem. If your defense is, well, that this is not appropriate, then that may save you from the revocation, but it doesn't attack the nature of the order in the first instance. With that, I'm happy to address any points we've not covered from the brief.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Katz.
Thank you.
Counsel, you have a minute left on your rebuttal time.
I'll just be very quick. Thank you, Mr. Katz, for your comments about the mootness issue. Finally, why this is not just grounded, my assignments of error is not just grounded in the fact that he was convicted of subsequent offense, petty larceny. It's grounded in the circumstances of the defendant, his personal circumstances. Because of the very broad language in the viewing prong of the special condition, obviously there could be things that he could look at or read that would, although dirty or pornographic or whatever, that would not aggravate his abusive nature. Some would. The point is, no one knew. No one knew then. The defendant didn't know. And I don't know. So, anyway, any questions?
Questions. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll come down and greet counsel.